As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now, the microeconomist from the University of Chicago, Jeffrey Curry, holds court at Goldman Sachs as global head of commodity research. Jeff, love your note where you really go into the price theory off the dollar of your commodity space. You have something that I would suggest 104% of our listeners and viewers don't understand. Commodities, year to date in Japan, up 51%. Year to date in the United States, up 22%. The dollar matters, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's why we titled the piece Dollar Dominant. And the main point there is, as the U.S. hikes interest rates faster than the rest of the world, you get a divergence in global interest rates, which then in turn puts upward pressure on the dollar. So funding costs in dollar increase, and then people deleverage dollar-denominated assets, and commodities are one. I don't care if it's a financially held one or a physically held one. You'd rather liquidate that and hold cash paying 5% than take the risk of that. And then what happens? Deflation sets in dollar-denominated assets. That deflation then increases real U.S. incomes, which then puts more upward pressure on interest rates. And so it's a vicious negative feedback loop.
Take us to supply and demand then, and I guess we could go to the next OPEC meeting if we really wanted to, but do you throw general equilibrium study of oil out the window because of this excess dollar move?
Really good question, and it keeps me up at night. And like, here's the way I'm thinking about it is, let's go to the definition of inflation. Too much money chasing too few goods. So you have two conditions to get inflation: too much money and too few goods. We still have too few goods. The oil market is in a deficit, inventories are low, but what's happening? Money supply is shrinking. And so that's taking the price level and driving it down, even though you still have too few goods. So, you know, we look at the fundamental picture. Our base case is it's going to continue to tighten as we go into year end. And particularly, you take out the SPR barrels, you get stabilization in China, oil to gas substitution in Europe. This market's going to get tighter and tighter as we go into the winter months. So if we need to see some stability in money supply or in the dollar in terms of thinking about that liquidity issue, then those fundamentals can press higher. But I think right now you need to really separate what's happening on the money supply side and what's happening on the fundamental supply and demand side.
One aspect of the story, Jeff, that's gotten a bit lost in the recent turmoil and worry about a recession is possible capacity to produce. And there was a story out today talking about how OPEC Plus may actually cut its production at its next meeting. How much do you expect something like that, not necessarily in response to the price going down, but in response to a lack of capacity to continue to produce at levels that they're doing now?
Well, I mean, if they're data dependent, if they're going to cut production, they're doing it because they look at the market being in a surplus, and that's what makes sense. But in terms of thinking about the overall capacity, that should affect longer-term prices, which is one of the reasons why we're bullish long-dated, long-term oil prices. We can, you're out of capacity, which means you have to forward invest. And ultimately, that's what you know can solve this problem. But to attract that capital, you need higher long-dated prices, which is why in our note we recommended going long-dated oil for precisely that reason.
What about natural gas? I know it's a hard pivot because it's a different asset class, but we're seeing a bit of overlap here as Europe faces a winter of discontent where they're flat on their back. Where is the extra margin of supply going to come from for Europe at a time when the U.S. is exporting more than it ever has and is facing some constraints with production there?
Well, I think the answer to that is look domestically. You're going to get it through weaker demand. You know, we're bearish European natural gas going into January and February and see it trading below 100 euros per megawatt hour. Why? I like to point out no one ever gets hit by the train they see coming in the sense that, you know, the disruption happened in August. So you were able to make adjustments by reducing demand, industrial demand destruction, making substitution into other fuels. So we believe, you know, barring an absolutely freezing cold winter, they're going to get through this winter. Prices are going to moderate. But longer term, you have a problem. To go to your point, you know, you have to, you know, come up with supplies, whether it's through exports of LNG or domestic investment or substitution in other fuels. So longer term, you've got a problem in Europe.
Jeffrey, unfair question, but it's unfair Thursday. What is the optimal price of a barrel of oil for OPEC?
Well, if you look at where the equilibrium price should be, you know, it should be somewhere in that $85, $95 a barrel. Given the fact that that's where probably the cost structure in the U.S. Why do we know it's got to be somewhere in that vicinity? Because rigs were rising when we were above 100. And since we've been now below that 190, let's call it around 100, rig counts in the U.S. are coming off. They're off about 20, 25 rigs over the last 3 to 4 weeks, which is telling you're getting down in these levels. You're now below the equilibrium price. So somewhere in that, I'd say $95, $100 a barrel seems to be where the market's functioning. And we also look at, you know, that's where our price target is in 4Q, $100 a barrel. And, you know, the potential for upside around that, I think, is substantial, going back to the point that, you know, we're out of spare capacity.
Hey, Jeff, wonderful to hear from you. It's been too long. Jeff Curry there of Goldman Sachs. Thank you, buddy. Wonderful as always. Thank you very much.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Our team is committed to bringing you voices within this crisis, and there's none on policy and economics more competent in this world than Michael Spence, the laureate of Stanford, New York University, and of course, chairman of General Atlantic's Global Growth Institute. Professor Spence, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I want to go to another time and place in your youth when you were studying with John Hicks long ago. Let us go, folks, to 1981. In William Grider's classic, The Atlantic Essay, on a very young David Stockman. The whole thing is premised on faith. The inflation premium melts away like the morning mist, a great battle over the conventional theories of economic performance. David Stockman in the middle of Reaganomics. Michael Spence, the tumult of the last 48 hours seems like a Reaganomics redux. Is it?
It looks like it, Tom, but I actually don't think it is. So both Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher were dealing with a situation in which you had embedded inflation, but also, you know, kind of stagflation pattern, low growth. And they were basically trying to remove the constraints and obstacles to higher rates of growth. That meant cutting back government and cutting back, you know, unfortunate and dysfunctional regulation. I think this is a completely different situation. We've lived in the, you know, liberated economics world for a long time, and we're actually going a different direction. So I mean, policies are always context specific, but I don't think this is analogous to that situation.
So then what situation is this? What is the policy prescription for the United Kingdom, or quite frankly, China or any others? What is the new Spence prescription?
Well, it starts with recognizing that, you know, for a whole variety of reasons, we have quite suddenly shifted into a supply constrained world. So, you know, growth strategies based on expanding demand don't make any sense. I mean, I think that's the core of the mistake that's been made in the UK. You just don't cut taxes if the supply side can't respond, especially if you're fighting the central bank, who's trying to get, you know, nearly out of control inflation back under control. And then at that, you know, and I think you have to face the fact that in the short run, we don't have any choice. The supply side agenda that we really need, you know, reversing the productivity trends isn't going to happen overnight. So the central banks, who are a little late to the game, but in an awkward position, just have to, you know, deal with the inflation thing by trimming back the demand side as best they can and as delicately as they can. But then the rest of the agenda should be focused on real supply side constraints, both domestic and global. And there are a lot of them: aging populations, you know, fading deflationary pressures from the emerging economies, diversification in global supply chains, the energy transition in Europe. I mean, the list is very long and I won't bore you with the whole thing, but you know, that's the situation that we have to do. Bottom line is we need a productivity surge.
Without that, or to get there, there is also an issue with how do you fiscally arrange a situation where deficits are not easy to finance anymore. How concerned are you about the inability of a lot of nations to finance some of the developments required to increase productivity, required to increase growth in the face of inflation that is persistent?
I'm very worried. I mean, you know, one of the other sort of constraints that you talked about before, Lisa, was the rising levels of sovereign debt. You know, and in a rising inflationary environment, you know, then that in many countries, maybe the United States is uniquely an exception, places fairly severe constraints on the kinds of investments that form a portion of, you know, sensible growth strategies, you know, supply side oriented growth strategies of the type that we, you know, the bills we passed recently in the U.S. So I think that's, you know, essentially a reason why we may not be able to dig our way out of this hole all that fast.
Well, to your recent writings on investments, sir, and I'm going to assume that Chad Jones, Berkeley to Stanford, was a Michael Spence disciple. He's got the definitive book on post-solo productivity, and that's all great. But the answer is we need capital deepening. How do we do that?
Well, I mean, you make sensible choices. So the first thing you don't do is cut government revenues, right? I mean, you know, if we're going to get out of this, we all have to pay a price. The politicians have a tough job convincing people that's right. But basically, you know, we have to finance the investments we need to get out of this. And that means probably some, at least holding fast on the tax situation, if not increasing them.
Michael Spence, thank you so much. An honor to have you with us today from always Stanford and New York University and Great Atlantic as well. Coming to us from Italy today. Right now, and this is a joy as we continue to bring in, to gather in people, as John mentioned, Dr. L. Arian, Jens Nordvig with us yesterday. I thought Alan Ruskin was wonderful with Deutsche Bank. Right now, Carl Weinberg, chief economist, high frequency economics, and far more out of the Lawrence Klein wing of the University of Pennsylvania with real world work in the rooms as these things get worked out. Carl, you nailed it this morning by saying, look, it's liquidation of bonds for cash. How will politicians respond to the threat of liquidation of bonds for cash?
Well, I think, good morning, Tom. Thank you. I'll try to live up to your introduction. You know, what the government can do is the government can give people a better reason to hold bonds, a prospect for thinking that inflation will come down and that'll bring down bond yields, a prospect for thinking that the public finances are stabilized, that'll bring down bond yields, a prospect for thinking that once inflation is under control, then growth will be able to resume, that'll bring down bond yields. But right now, we're not getting any of that in the UK, at least not in the judgment of the markets, as we're plainly seeing. And whether it's right, wrong, good, bad politics, it nonetheless seems to be the markets reading it as bad economics.
And how much is the Bank of England's response kind of the playbook for a lot of central banks going forward in terms of both hiking rates, keeping the front end high, and buying bonds to basically monetize a fiscal response, to monetize what the policymakers and government are going to be doing without completely upending the economy?
Hi, good morning, Lisa. That's all the right questions, and it's hard to know what the answers are. The Bank of England has done a good job of convincing everybody that inflation is rampant. And whether I agree with that or not, all right, that's what the market believes, and that's what the market expects. So having convinced the public, having generated expectations in the public that there is a true inflation problem and that the right answer to that is hiking rates, the Bank of England really has no choice but to continue to deliver the remedy for the problem that it's defined, and continue to raise interest rates. And it's going to have to raise them by a lot. If you look at their own inflation forecasts, which again, they aim to convince us are accurate forecasts, right? Real interest rates are nowhere near real positive, all right, let alone high enough to break the economy. And now add to it the fiscal stimulus. They have to, in order to deliver the promise, in order to play out the scene that they have set, they have to deliver much higher interest rates. And it won't be until they do, I think, that the market will find an equilibrium price.
Carl, have we reached the limits of deficit financing?
Well, certainly in the case of the UK, we have to say that the market isn't buying what the government is selling in terms of the amount of debt that it believes it can finance at this time. You know, in the longer term, you know, we're all dead, of course, but in the longer term, we can probably borrow a lot more than we are right now. But to amp up the game at such a rapid pace under these current circumstances, which is to say in opposition to the stated policy goals of the central bank, ignoring, if you will, the advice of the central bank governor and his committee and his economists and his analysis, all right, and going ahead and ramping up spending anyhow, that seems to be a move that pushed beyond credibility.
Carl Weinberg, September 1982, and of course, Daniel Yergin wrote this up beautifully in Commanding Heights. You were at the Bank of Montreal doing debt workouts on disasters in Latin America. What does Trussonomics 2 look like? How do they get from what everybody believes is a theoretical train wreck to whatever the outcome is? How do you get to Reaganomics 2? How do you get to Trussonomics 2?
Well, Tom, as I'm sure you've mentioned many times over the last couple of days, the Reagan administration cut taxes like mad and ran up the federal deficit like mad in the early days of its administration. But by the time we got to the end, they were raising taxes to pay for it. And all of the promises of supply side economics and voodoo economics or whatever you chose to call it didn't seem to work out. So I suspect that someday there will be a day of reckoning in the UK where they will have to unwind some of this. But it's pretty clear from the Prime Minister's statement that that's not going to happen this week or next week or the month even after.
Okay.
That.
I'm going to we got to continue this. John Farrell, jump in here. You're the guy from Britain as well. What does the 1922 committee do under your odd government in Britain?
Well, I think the market's going to dictate that, Tom, potentially over the next few weeks. And Carlo's right. For the next few weeks, at least, I think a lot of people don't see Liz Truss changing her mind. At the moment, Carl, this operation from the Bank of England goes until the middle of October. The concept we're all talking about now, Carl, is fiscal dominance. Walk us through that concept, Carl, and how well you think this Bank of England can push back against it.
Well, the Bank of England, John, as you know, has unlimited resources. It can raise interest rates to 1,000,000% if it wants to achieve its goals. It said what it wants to do. It said how it's going to do it. And I don't think it can or will back down. On terms of the government has limited fiscal resources. If it gets into a battle with the Bank of England over whether the economy should be stimulated or not, the Bank of England will win this. It's a question at what interest rate do we have to get there. The risk, the big risk, and John, I know you're conscious of this very much more so than I am, is that the government gets fed up with the Bank of England and starts to restrict its independence.
Yep.
On that day, sterling will go down the tubes, and on that day, gilt yields will soar to levels that I dare not even contemplate.
There was a whisper of that in August, and they tried to address it as soon as they took over. Carl, fantastic to hear from you, sir, as always. Carl Weinberg there of High Frequency Economics.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Right now, and this is a huge joy to know the team that Neil Soss of Credit Suisse put together decades ago at Credit Suisse. It included the giant Dominic Constum, now over at Mizuho, and still at Credit Suisse is Ray Ferris. He owned the high ground on Pacific Rim analysis and also foreign exchange in London for the shop. And we're thrilled that the chief economist at Credit Suisse joins us this morning. I'm going to cut right to the chase, Ray, and this goes into your foreign exchange background. Yesterday was original. What is the original solution for the prime minister?
Well, look, I'm thrilled to be here. I've been a long-time listener to the show, and it's great to be on. But I just wanted to address the elephant in the room. That is a fantastic bow tie. I love it. I think it was said a little bit earlier by one of the guests that, you know, the UK increasingly needs to be viewed in the context of an emerging market sort of situation. Not that they're going to default on their debt, but the economy has lost a nominal anchor for the system. And that's, I think, why investors don't want to hold bonds and they don't want to hold the currency.
Right.
The fiscal agent looks like it's a little out of control. And the Bank of England isn't stepping up to the plate to regain control, to establish that nominal anchor by saying that we don't care what happens on fiscal, we're going to control inflation. What needs to happen here is the Bank of England needs to step in. They need to be aggressive with their next rate hike. It'd be better if they move before November. And they need to signal that they will do more after that. Markets are pricing very high rates as the terminal rate. They don't have to get there if
right.
they act.
You have a huge credibility with Asia and with China, with Japan. And you come out and calculate 1.6% global growth for next year. Are we pricing for that?
No, I don't think we are. Certainly not in equities. The way we look at equities and I wear two hats at Credit Suisse. I'm chief economist, but also the chief investment officer for the Americas. About 3 weeks ago, we went underweight in our investment wealth division equities for the first time since 2013. That's really a huge move for us. And when we look at equities, we think, as we just published yesterday, our new economic quarterly, the worst is yet to come was the title. And it's all about the fact that nominal growth is going to slow. Financing costs are going up and wage growth, the persistence of a lot of costs, you know, are going to be there for another few quarters. So profits are going to get squeezed. Margins look too high. Consensus earnings look too high.
to that point, Ray, let's go back to some of the data that we just got. The initial jobless claims of 193,000. It was the expectation of 215,000. You hear the Fed saying that they want to see a little bit more slack in this labor market, or even a lot more, with the projection of 4.5% of an unemployment rate possibly by next year. How far away are we? What kind of Fed funds rate do we need to get to the type of slack, to the loosening of this labor market required to bring inflation down?
Oh, absolutely. The Fed's going to be angry about these numbers. We've got a forecast of 4.5%, well, really 4 5/8 for Fed funds as the terminal rate. But we stress we don't really know where this thing could peak, and that there's an asymmetry still in the Fed's reaction function to the top side. They have shown that they aren't going to ease just because numbers get or turn a little bit less hawkish, just because numbers get a bit better, the June-July CPI data. And they will respond aggressively if the numbers, you know, aren't so nice, the August CPI data. So could they hike beyond what the market's got priced, you know, the 4.5% for terminal rate next year? Yes. Do they, I think, just really dislike the idea that markets have got a cut price for 2023, and are they going to continue to argue against that? Absolutely.
Ray, we saw from the Bank of England the conundrum that's becoming increasingly a global conundrum and perhaps may face this Federal Reserve, which is, when do you reach the breaking point, and then how do they counteract that from a financial stability perspective? What is the break point when it comes to real yields, which we saw hit 1.6% just a few trading days ago? Where is the break point for this market and then for the Federal Reserve to have to step in on a stability stance?
Well, let me identify three different things here. The first is that one of the key reasons I think real yields are going as high as they are, back into positive territory, is that balance sheet strength in the United States, especially within the housing sector, is the best that it's been in, you know, depending on your metric, anywhere between 20 to 30 years. The Fed has to push up yields much more than we would have thought a year and a half, 2 years ago, to actually slow the system down. And that's kind of what the claims data. The second thing is, I'm here in Dallas. I was meeting with a lot of retail corporates yesterday. And when I asked, are we in a recession, everybody in the room put their hand up. The key thing here is there's a dichotomy in this economy. The goods sector, the cyclical components, housing and goods, already are in a recession. Services is doing just fine. And that's where you're getting this continued labor force growth, now some real income growth, and the Fed's just going to have to keep pushing against it.
Futures deteriorate on negative 1.4% S&P futures. The VIX out two big figures, 32.23, not through the highs yesterday, but the stress is out there off of the good news we saw on claims. Ray Ferris, I want to speak to you about the U.S. economy and the Fed's path forward. If we get a real rate out to 2.05%, which is my calculation of maybe great financial crisis average before the crisis, I should say, do you suggest they need to overshoot on the real rate to really turn things around? Or can they go to just above 2% and stabilize, sit there?
We think that they're going to be able to, our base case is that they're going to be able to pull off a tiny bit of growth. And a lot of that is because of this balance sheet position that households are in. If we're going to go into a recession in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months, it's not going to be because we're forced into it by financial distress. It's going to be because consumers choose to retrench. But with this type of employment growth, they're probably not going to do that. Do we have to get the, you know, now very fashionable vacancy to unemployment ratio down a lot to get wage growth to come down? Well, history says no. Vacancy to unemployment doesn't actually forecast wage growth very well. So we think it's going to be a tough fight. The Fed's probably going to have to go to 4.5%. They could go a bit above that. But, you know, we've got employment growth, payrolls coming down to 150 or so by the end of the year, early next year. And then, you know, I think the risk is maybe we go a bit softer. Gradually, that'll pull down wage growth. Goods inflation is going to come down. Looks like housing on a forecast basis has already peaked. Services are going to be a problem for a while, but they're going to edge off. So we're optimistic that by the end of next year, the Fed's going to be much closer to where it wants to be without necessarily having to pull the economy into a recession.
Ray, Tom's going to send you a signed bow tie. How would you like that?
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait.
I'll make it happen. Ray Ferris there at Credit Suisse.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.